Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Carl Hiaasen was born and raised in Florida, and he sets his newest novel, Razor Girl, in Key West. Razor Girl is a work of fiction, but Hiaasen comes across all sorts of off-the-wall, real-life stories as a columnist for the Miami Herald. And in fact, before the novel begins, there is a page which states, "True events in South Florida provided the lurid material for certain strands of this novel, beginning with the opening scene." And thus, Hiaasen begins a tale of kidnapping and mayhem with a natural redhead who's perfected an eye-popping scam. There's also a reality show star and would-be redneck named Buck Nance, who's really an accordionist from Wisconsin. Andrew Yancey, whom readers first met in the novel Bad Monkey, sadly has been demoted from his job as detective. There are giant Gambian rats and mobsters, and the book, suffice it to say, is a romp on the wild side. So we'll let Carl Hiaasen take it from there. Carl, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so let's begin with the title and a synopsis of the opening scene, remembering this is a family program.
Yes. Well, a couple years ago down in Key West, there was an automobile accident involving a carload of tourists. Nobody was hurt, but a vehicle smashed them from behind. And when the police arrived, they found that the driver of the vehicle was a woman who had been conducting some personal grooming while she was driving at high speed and had become distracted and smashed into this other car. And she had the razor in her hand and an innocent look on her face. And the story gets better from there. But I had filed this away along with a lot of the weird stuff that people send me, and just thought about trying someday to get it into a novel because I didn't know how to improve upon it. When the cops asked this driver, why are you doing that while you're driving your car? Her explanation was, well, you know, I've got a date down in Key West. I want to look nice. And then they said, well, who's that in the car with you? And she said, oh, that's my husband. It was one of those Florida romances that, you know, could have been a whole novel in itself.
You can't make this stuff up. You didn't have to.
No, I didn't. So I just, in the book, in the novel, in real life, it was an accident. In the novel, as it opens, it turns out not to be an accident, but a deliberate crash, which we also have an abundance of in Florida.
And thus you get the novel rolling with this deliberate crash. Let's go to a couple of points in the book. You give reality TV a big poke in the eye in this book. Tell us a bit about the TV show Bayou Brethren. Who are the stars? Let's start there.
Well, we sort of have a Duck Dynasty craze going on now. And, yeah. And you, being from the South and being a white guy from the South, you know, I can't help but notice the national fixation with redneck culture, which actually exists in every single state in the Union, but imprinted in the South. So this, in my book, Bayou Brethren is just sort of a ripoff, riding the crest of Duck Dynasty, and they needed some rednecks. And they found these guys that were in an accordion band from Wisconsin that had the great beards, and they had the look, and they said, you want to be in your own reality show? And it was Buck Nance and his three brothers, and it paid a lot better than accordion music did at the time, so they signed up, and the show became a huge hit. So they placed them as high-end chicken farmers in a Louisiana bayou, when in fact it's sort of a set in Pensacola, Florida, and they had to come in, bring in some coaches to train them how to be, you know, rednecks, and how to. They have a Cajun dialect coach. They have people, just because they're just dudes from Wisconsin. But this television, it's Hollywood.
They become
a giant hit, and Buck starts to believe his own press clippings and does these little rants on YouTube that are not politically correct, to put it mildly. And they build him a fake church, and he becomes a fake deacon. And so he gives rants about immigration and about the gay community. He starts saying things that he thinks his audience will dig, and then he sort of runs in face to face in Key West, Florida, with an audience that isn't too crazy about what he's saying, and that's how the book sort of opens with him running through for his life through the streets of Key West. He got some bad intelligence about Key West, not his prime market.
A little more diverse than he had expected.
Yeah.
So Carl Hyacin, would you mind reading a passage for us? It's on page 58, I believe, in the book.
Oh boy. Okay. Now I'll try to read this. Some of this is, I have to tell you, I haven't read from the book publicly. I'm just, you know, getting on the tour. So I'm going to do my best with this and try to, again, mindful of the sensitivity of your audience here. The election of a black president brought a boom in TV reality shows featuring feisty rednecks, and talent scouts began scouring the Dixie Belt in a fevered search for the next Duck Dynasty franchise. Buck Nance and the Brawlers were discovered at a Howard Johnson's off the interstate near Chattanooga, playing a toned-down set for a Catholic bachelorette party. They were flown business class to Los Angeles for a meeting at Platinum Artists with John David Ampergroat, who pronounced the Romberg brothers perfect except for their superior dental work. He promised them fame and wealth and presented a 2-year management contract, sent them by limousine to a Malibu orthodontist to get their front teeth darkened and chipped. Matthew was allowed to keep the stage name of Buck, while his brothers chose their own from a list of homespun monikers provided by the agency. The transition from obscure regional musicians to wildly popular television stars put a strain on the brothers' fraternal bond. From the beginning, the creators of Bayou Brethren felt the show should revolve around the colorful Buck character and the iron-willed Crystal, his wife. Inevitably, resentment took root among the other family members. Junior, Buddy, and Cleroy also had wives who enjoyed being recognized in the supermarket, and they wanted their own storylines. Tension between the younger brothers and Buck began to worsen during the tapings, a situation which elated the director, a pragmatic Brit named Damien Poe. Soon he began placing fungo bats at strategic locations throughout the Nance compound in hopes that one of the siblings would snap while the cameras were rolling.
What do you really think of reality TV, Carl Hyacin? Any redeeming qualities?
Oh, I mean, it's vastly entertaining. Yeah. I end up watching some of these shows. I love, like, Deadliest Catch, and that stuff's great stuff. I mean, if you're, you know, after a day of work, you come in and there is a voyeuristic aspect to it, but also not all of it's real. And that's the other thing, that it just isn't real as they're telling you. And in this case, they just need a bunch of guys who look like, you know, ZZ Top, and they're just cashing in, and that's sort of Hollywood cashing in.
So you bring back Andrew Yancey, who appeared, as we said earlier, in Bad Monkey. Who is he, for those who are not familiar with that book, and why has he been reduced to inspecting restaurants for health violations?
Well, we call it Roach Patrol in Florida. He was a very good detective, and he got a little bit of trouble in Miami, so he ended up down in the Keys as a detective, and his personal life went astray. And there was an incident at the Mallory Square docks, where the cruise ships unload in Key West, and lots of people with cell phones. He was trying to defend the honor of a woman who wasn't really looking to have her honor defended at that time, and he was using a dustbuster in a – how should I put this, against her husband in a, there was a proctological aspect to the confrontation. Let me just leave it at that. So Yancey got, it was bad press, bad publicity, and the sheriff said, we can't have you on the force anymore, but I'm not going to fire you. I'm going to get you this job as restaurant inspector. And we sort of leave him, you know, in Bad Monkey. He's struggling. I mean, he tries to do everything honorably. So he's trying to do his best job as a restaurant inspector, counting roach pieces and mouse droppings, and at the same time trying to get his real job back by solving crimes on the side. And I felt bad kind of at the end of Bad Monkey that I didn't give him a better career move, so I thought I'd give him another shot in Razor Girl.
And he has quite an adventure in Razor Girl, a number of them. And just for a moment, for his job as an inspector, you do bring again a little touch of real life, Florida real life, into this book in introducing, well, to most of the rest of the world, giant Gambian rats.
They're Gambian pouched rats, not giant rats. They're pouched rats, yeah. They were brought into the country back in the 70s because some genius thought that this is just what the American pet trade needed, that Americans would line up to buy rats so large that you had to put them on a leash. They grow to 8 or 9 pounds, and they're a real creature. But the feds stepped in and stopped the importation a few years later. And this guy down in the Lower Keys, this true story, had optimistically started a little colony of them that he was hoping to breed and sell. And when the whip came down, he did what all the python owners in South Florida do. They just opened the cages and says, you know, hit the bricks, boys. And so there's some free roaming Gambian pouch rats. And I'd heard these stories for years, and I just thought it would be nice to put – Yancey needed a proper adversary on one of his restaurant inspections. I just thought that would be a restaurant inspector's nightmare, is to go head-to-head with a 9-pound pouch rat. And so it just – but in a tasteful way, of course.
Mm, of course. So bearing in mind that nobody I know knew that these rats existed and that some of them actually lived in South Florida, do you have the state tourism people, you know, running for the antacid or patting you on the back for your work? Oh, you hope so?
Oh, no, God, I'd be in trouble. If they liked what I did, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. You know, I've been – ever since I started with the first novel, Tourist Season – many, many years ago. I mean, I don't think I'm on anybody's Christmas list at the Chamber of Commerce, which is fine with me. Nor, you know, in the newspaper column, same thing. You're not doing your job if you're getting, you know, a cheerleading from the establishment. But sure. I mean, this stuff really happened. I mean, look, we got all kinds of stuff. And the Gambian pouch rats really don't present as near a big a threat as these, you know, giant pythons and everything else. And not to mention just the general chaos of South Florida. So I think they got worse things to worry about, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and again, back to Andrew Yancey, now, you know, detective turned inspector. He does end up tangling with the redhead, Mary Mansfield,
yes.
I think her name is. And you know what?
Yeah.
I know this is a family show, but I kind of regret that at the beginning of the show, we didn't talk about the fact that her scam involved, you know, her shaving her bikini line. We can say that.
The newspaper just shaving her bikini area. Is the way that that's the newspaper jargon for it, you know.
Okay. So Yancey is fighting his attraction for Mary Mansfield. And she's somebody who can't be tied down.
No, and I liked her a lot. Sometimes you start with these characters and you don't know how they're going to work out or how long you're going to be able to handle and deal with them, you know, in the story is if you're writing it. But she just swept Yancey along, and sort of everybody in her orbit gets swept along. And she, of course, is the smartest one in the novel because she's running this scam. And she gets hired by people to crash into other people and distract them. And her targets are always male drivers because men are just completely, you know, helpless. In the face of that kind of...
They get distracted easily.
Anyway, and this is, something that would seriously distract you. And so, I mean, as she says in the novel, I'm not just a great driver, I'm a performance artist. And she's got she's just got a terrific energy. When she's on the page, I was having fun writing the book, I wasn't always sure what she was going to do, but that's the best kind of characters.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. There's so many moving parts to this novel. Could you give us kind of a quick synopsis so it can help get our arms around the plot of the novel for our listeners?
Well, at the beginning of the book, she crashes into the wrong guy. She crashes into the wrong car, and it turns out to be Buck Nance's manager who's rushing to Key West to save him from himself at this performance. So, and that's how it gets rolling.
Okay, Carl Hyacin is our guest. His latest novel is Razor Girl. We're talking about that, and Hyacin's also a longtime columnist for the Miami Herald, and as such has a lot to say about life in Florida. As always, you're welcome to join us for the conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay here. Radio Times continues in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Carl Hyacin is a novelist whose latest work is called Razor Girl. He's also written a column for the Miami Herald for the past 3 decades or so. And he writes children's books as well. Hoot is one of his bestsellers, and it was made into a major motion picture. And if you'd like to jump into the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes at whyy.org. And just continuing along with the story for just a moment or so more, as you referenced a little bit earlier, Carl, the show made Buck Nance, in quotation marks, a pastor. And I think the name of the church is the First Chickapaw Tabernacle of Hope and Holiness, where Buck apparently rants against anyone who isn't a white Christian. And, he's won the attention of an unhinged fan named Blister Krill. And if you could read a passage for us, I think it starts on page 160. Yeah, Blister.
Tell me which.
160, and it begins, Benny the Blister.
There we go. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah, this is one of my favorite guys here. Benny the Blister's fanatic passion for Bayou Brethren sprang from an induced sense of kinship with Buck and his rowdy family. The show's producers had strategically cultivated a fandom with two distinct segments, those who were cynically amused by the boorish culture of the Nance Clan and those who identified with it. Each week, the writers strived to portray the brothers on a social bandwidth halfway between harmless rednecks and odious white trash. It was a precarious tight wire. From the very first episode, Blister Krill could imagine the brothers' severe opinions about homos, transgenders, blacks, Muslims, Hispanics, and probably Jews. Although the show's scripts steered away from touchy political messaging, Buck's bootleg YouTube rants had convinced Blister that he and Buck were on the same righteous page ideologically. The patriarch's tirades were mostly outtakes from the weekly TV tapings that had been leaked to the internet by disgruntled crew members, much to the rapture of hardcore Brethren cultists. The abduction of Buck Nance had unfolded spontaneously with no criminal intent. Of course, Blister had been front and center at the Parched Pirate when Buck fled the angry mob. Blister had tried to catch up, running as fast as a nearsighted, half-drunk imbecile could run, but Buck had vanished in the maze of fragrant alleys that crisscrossed Old Town.
Oh, my gosh. There's humor in almost every sentence in this book. How do you write or construct humor into a sentence so, at least to your ears, it's pitch perfect? How long does that take you?
It takes a long time. I mean, I think with humor, also you want the pace of the thing. You want it to be moving. There's suspense and all of it, but you want people laughing on every page, so you agonize over adjectives. Dialogue gets a lot of work because, as you know, you can be off by a beat or the rhythm can be a little off of a line and it's not as funny. So, yeah, you spend a lot of time, you know, in your head and looking at the paper and saying, is it working or not? To sustain a narrative tone that's funny and also move a story along or several sub-stories in my case, it's very stressful and it probably makes my family crazy because I come home from the office looking like, I got hit by a 2x4 some days.
Well, this is, the first of your books that I've read, and it's chock full of characters and plots and twists and turns. And, my impression was that you have an exceptionally busy mind, Carl Heisen.
I think that's a charitable way of saying it. I mean, I think it's psychotherapy. I think this is a socially acceptable way to deal with, not only what's happening in Florida, but the national culture, because a lot of, Florida is sort of on the cutting edge of national dysfunction. If something starts going wrong in Florida, it'll soon start going wrong in the rest of the country. And that's been that way for many, many years. It was certainly on display during the 2000 presidential election with the Gore Bush stuff. So the whole country got to see it then. So it's not a big secret.
Well, I was hunting around online just for some background here. And in an interview you did about 10 years ago, Carl Heisen, with Steve Croft of 60 Minutes, there's this quote: "The Sunshine State," I have one here, "is a paradise of scandals teeming with drifters, deadbeats, and misfits drawn here by some dark primordial calling like demented trout. And you'd be surprised how many of them decide to run for public office."
That's true. That's true. And if you're writing a newspaper column, as I have, it is literally, to extend the metaphor, like shooting fish in a barrel. Every day there's some new atrocity against the public that you can, take a shot at as a column. And that's good therapy, too, because it's immediate. It's in the paper. And the books are writing the books are a little bit of a different muscle. It's long term. And you're trying to sort of extend the characterizations, but just being able to react as a columnist is also a very healthy thing. And it's a privilege in a place where you were born and raised and, still have that forum after all these years.
Well, one more quote from the Croft interview: "Politicians are much more comfortable being made fun of than they are being preached at and screeched at." So I take it humor is your weapon of choice.
Right. No, they really hate it when you make fun of them. I think you look at the presidential election. Mockery and scorn are the most effective weapons, and really the only appropriate weapons to deal with some of what's happening. You can get on a soapbox and yell at these guys all day. They're used to it. But if you really make fun of them, if you really hit the nail on the head with a satirical column or something, you know, close to the bone, that's when they start to squirm, and that's when they really get miserable. And that's what, of course, all columnists love to see.
Well, let me reintroduce you, Carl Hyacin. His latest novel, I believe, is it your 15th novel?
Oh, God, I don't know, Mary. I lost track. If you count the kids' books, I think it's 18th to 19th, something like that.
Okay,
I
mean, so heading toward 20. Yeah. His latest novel is Razor Girl, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We actually have a call from Dave, who's on the New Jersey Turnpike. Welcome to Radio Times, Dave.
Well, thank you, Mary, and hello, Carl.
Hey, Dave, drive safe.
Yes, sir, we're doing our best. I just wanted to ask you, is it true that you are a graduate of Plantation High School? My sister bragged that she was in the same class that you were.
I did. I graduated in 1970 from Plantation. I don't know why they let me out. 1970. That's correct.
Small world.
It is a small world.
Yeah, best regards, then, from my sister Brenda, who I think I might try to get this book for her as a gift, because it's... I'm sure she reads it and maybe it reads your stuff, and maybe I can get it before she actually buys it.
All right. Well, tell her I said hello.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. All right. So, well, you've lived in Florida all your life, Carl Hyacin. What is it about Florida that's kept you there?
Well, I grew up in – my childhood was very rural, you know, on the edge of the Everglades, and I grew up in all this just outdoors and ride my bike and fishing and camping and doing this stuff. I mean, it was a very, very wonderful childhood in that sense. And then when you see that – all that place paved over and subdivided and built up, it pisses you off. And so I think from a very young age I can remember being angry at sort of the machinery of greed and overdevelopment. And from a very young age. So the writing is – I stay there because there's a lot of it that's still there and still worth fighting for. And also you don't want to walk away from a fight like that. I mean my grandkids and my oldest son are still down there. And I mean my family lives there. So I mean it's a place that you could – you know, I could probably live anywhere I wanted to. But it's one of the more interesting places to be involved in some – serious issues that are happening all over the country, but also fighting for some place you love. I guess that's that simple.
Yeah. Well, you do, you know, as humorous as this book is, you do have some, there are some serious undertones. And let's bring the character of Martin Trabeau into the conversation.
Oh, God.
The owner of Sedimental Journeys. And tell us a little bit about this guy.
Well, this is a true thing in Florida. When we have, you know, we have rising sea levels, we have hurricanes, we have nor'easters that come through and take big chunks of the beach. And people panic when the beach starts disappearing because the beach is worth a lot of money in Florida. So there are these companies that will bring you a new beach. And you have to pay them a lot of money, and it's called beach renourishment. That's our euphemism for it. And they'll barge. They'll either dredge some sand offshore, which wrecks the reefs, and they'll pipe it, big pipes, back onto your beach, or they'll bring it. They'll bring sand from the Bahamas over, and they'll put that down. And it's the greatest gig in the world because a year later they got to redo it all again because nature doesn't really care. It just comes back and takes the beach away. But it's a classic Florida thing, the panic that sets in when beachfront starts to disappear naturally like that. And so Martin Trabeau gets into this business, and he's just, you know, this guy, like a lot of the characters in my book, he takes some shortcuts, and he gets some sand that isn't really very good. It's got even broken glass in it at some point. It's come from a rock pit in West Dade, and he makes the mistake of laying it behind a resort that's owned by one of the mafia families, one of the families
Big Noogie,
in New York.
Is that his name?
Big Noogie Aola, yeah. And he notices that the people that are at it, it's a very nice property, a resort. The mob can run some nice places, you know. And he's noticed, though, that the guests are running up from the beach screaming with their feet bloody.
Oh, my gosh.
And he realizes that he's gotten sold a bad beach. And he goes after Trabeau, and he hires Mary, the Razor Girl herself, to crash into the car and distract Trabeau long enough so that they can grab him. And that's how that's how the misbeginning starts, because she's supposed to be crashing into the Sandman when she actually hits poor Buck Nance's agent. So that's how the chaotic beginning. But there is – beach renourishment is a huge, huge business in Florida because – you know, the tide and the hurricanes and the rising water, they don't pay any attention to what humans want. They yeah. just keep doing their thing.
And another one of the funnier themes running through the book is that of, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the product called Petrolux.
Oh yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, Petrolux. I've been, you know, you watch these ads, especially if you watch a lot of sports, and there's, you know, you have your ads for the. All the erectile dysfunction stuff for guys, and they always it's always on the Golf Channel, and it's always on NFL football for some reason. But anyway, so I thought, and they have all these different stuff that's out there now, and I thought, and one of them is this cream that you smear in your armpits, right? And I thought, why not combine that with the deodorant product? Someone's going to think of this eventually, and they're welcome to my idea. But anyway, so this product comes out in my book called Petrolux, where you not only are smearing hormones on yourself and improving your waning sex life in middle age, but you get the benefit of deodorant protection. So obviously, it's a defective product, and I have a lawyer who specializes in defective products. And you
that
know,
would be Brock Richardson, right?
Yeah, there's all these niche class action suits now if you watch TV. I mean, there's big ads. Most obscure disorders and diseases, they want you to sign up and sue. And so he's doing ads for Petrolux saying, man, if you've ever used this stuff, sign up with me and we'll get you in a class action and all these horrible deformities. But then he figures it's all just baloney, a hype, and he starts using some on the side, just seeing if it really works.
Well, wait, let me jump in because I do have a passage for you to read about Richardson. Yeah, just one more. It's on page 130. Starting with no one should. And while you're looking for that, another strand kind of is woven in here. Richardson's also trying to build a supersized gaudy home on the lot next to Yancey's. That's a whole other part of the story.
He's trying to build a McMansion in this tiny little neighborhood in Big Pine Key. So he is now Yancey's mortal enemy. And so that's the subtext. But okay. Richardson pops up, and I'll read this section to you.
Sure.
And no one should have known better than Brock Richardson that Petrolux was dangerous, that the male body could not safely absorb and metabolize thrice daily applications of strong deodorizing chemicals juiced with male hormones. Yet because he merely farmed out product liability cases and had never actually litigated one, Richardson assumed the allegations against Petrolux were hyped, a common tactic in his field. He would have spared himself much misery by studying the victim's sworn statements or just scanning a summary of the expert testimony, but he'd never done that before. Not in the Ambrosia flammable diaper lawsuit, not in the Ram Vigor vitamin contamination case, not even in the Lamb gland injectables class action. Richardson's only role was to troll for fresh plaintiffs using slick TV spots in which he starred as the pinstriped, doom-faced messenger of gruesome manifestations. The diverse Petrolux litany included excessive hair growth, facial and torso, elongated larynxes, unwanted testicular enlargement, often bilateral, suppurating acne, random tissue deformities, and life-threatening erections, just to name a few. Long before the 90 seconds of infomercial horror was over, Richardson's 800 phone lines would light up. Sympathetic-sounding paralegals would interview the callers, winnow the whack jobs, and hook up the others with a legitimate law practice. When the claims got settled, as such cases usually did, Richardson would receive a very sweet slice of the pie. It was a system that had already made him a multimillionaire. He couldn't remember the last time a live client had walked through his door, and what would be the purpose of such a visit? Except for the wall of uncracked legal books that served as the backdrop for Richardson's TV ads, his law office looked more like a Calcutta call center.
Goodness. And of course, concealed in his suit closet is a 12-pack of Petrolux. So we know he gets his somewhere along the way.
Right. He literally gets his. Gets him, I guess.
Again, Carl Heisen, what does this whole Petrolux caper say about people and vanity?
Well, of course, but I mean, again, I think Florida was one of the first in the country that had all these ridiculous lawyer ads, and now everywhere you go, and I mean, even in Canada, you cannot escape. If you're using some product, whatever it is, there's a lawyer out there waiting to sue for whatever imagined or real side effect you might have. I mean, it's just the culture we live in. It's litigious. It's all about money. I mean, I always look to my home state first for any kind of, the moral degradation factor, which is great if you're writing satire. If you're a citizen and you care about the future of humanity, it gives you pause.
Okay. Well, taking maybe a serious turn here for a moment, we've got an email from a listener in Stone Harbor who asks, are the terms white trash and redneck becoming less acceptable? If they ever were, it seems that these people are often the targets of derision. Why is there a tolerance for portraying poor, less advantaged whites, and do we have less compassion for them?
No, I don't. I think that, first of all, being born in the South and being a white guy, I've lived my whole life with people saying, you must be a redneck, because I was born in Lauderdale and you can't get much farther south than that. But my view of rednecks, and it's not about income level, it's about the stereotyping of people who, and they're out there, who some of them who have a sort of a low threshold for tolerance for other people and who act it out. And that's the whole point of this reality TV show craze, was sort of to exploit that stereotype. Mm-hmm. But you go around the South, you can go in any state in the Union and find what are popularly perceived or called as rednecks. And in the South, it's almost a term of affection, or at least fraternalism. Yeah. You know, we have people where I live that have, that plaster their trucks with the Confederate flags, and they couldn't tell you the first thing about the Civil War. And trust me when I tell you there was no Civil War connection to Vero Beach, yeah, Florida. There was no great battles fought there. Yeah. Just trust me on that. But they just decided that they identified with that. Oh, yeah, we're going to stand up in your face. And in that case, you're putting a symbol out there that offends lots and lots of people. Now, why are you doing that? Because you're a rebel and you're an independent, or because you're making a statement about race?
Yeah. And to be fair, you do skewer a number of different groups in this book.
Everybody gets skewered, of course. But they're out there, and I grew up with a bunch of them, and everybody knows. And there's lots. It's not about income level, or education level. It's about an attitude, and that again is there seems to be a fascination with that in reality TV right now.
All right, we're talking to Carl Hiaasen, his latest novel Razor Girl, and the number to call if you'd like to jump in, 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send us a comment, we will try to get it on the air. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org. We've got more Radio Times just ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Carl Hiaasen is a novelist whose latest work is called Razor Girl. He's also written a column for the Miami Herald for the last several decades. And three decades. Okay. So anyway, and the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. All right. So let's go to your work as a columnist for the Miami Herald. And a political columnist is that at that. So talking about the politicians on the federal and state levels, let's start with the presidential candidates. You pull no punches when it comes to Donald Trump. Writing in early August, the easiest job in politics belongs to the people who are producing Hillary Clinton's attack ads against Donald Trump. And these are your words. All they've got to do is wait for this bumbling gas bag to open his mouth, and he basically writes their columns for them. So, well, since you wrote this, Trump has gotten a new team in place. He's visited Mexico. Yeah. He's seemingly trying to clean up his act a bit and tone it down a bit. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, they're trying to control him, obviously, because when he goes unscripted is when he starts saying these remarks, and it's almost like he's looking for new people to offend. I mean, you have to, again, if you write satire, this is a gold mine. This is the most fertile election year of all time. You have two of the most widely disliked candidates for the top office that have ever run against each other. I mean, you couldn't pick two candidates with higher negative ratings right now. But Trump, of course, is a performer. He's a TV guy. That's what he is. And so he plays to the crowd, and then he'll always go off script and say something that he has to explain or back away from or change his position on within 24 hours. It's if you're covering him, it's entertaining at all times. But people who think they know who he is, I feel sorry for these people who actually think that he's going to that he has the power to build a wall between Mexico and they're just suckers.
Yeah.
If they don't understand executive power, they don't understand the function of Congress, and they sure don't understand the reality of trying to get thousands of miles of right of way to put a giant wall in. I mean, Trump's grandchildren won't be around to see that wall. It'll still be a dream. His great grandchildren, there'll be no wall. But there are people out there, some of them, I think, who really think that he's going to do this. And all you can do is have pity for him.
And, well, how about Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, the Clinton factor, the email thing is ridiculous. That's a great idea. I'm going to have a private email server as Secretary of State. I mean, I don't know what they're thinking. For people who are smart, and everyone who knows her says how smart she is, that's not a very smart thing to do. They haven't found anything that compromised national security, but it was stupid and it was a little sneaky, and people have this suspicion about that. I don't, I think it's all going to come down to, if you're looking at the big picture, this is it, and a lot of elections are like this, Mary. It's who is least likely to blow up the planet? Who is least likely to get us into another war? People forget what Barack Obama was handed as president, economic disaster, where the economy is on the edge of a cliff, and we got two wars we can't get out of. Yeah. And we got Arlington filling up with people, our men and women are getting killed in Iraq. All this is going on. This is a heavy deal. It's a heavy situation. We can make fun of it, and we have to make fun of it to stay sane. But it's a big deal this year to decide, okay, who is the least likely person to get us into trouble.
Yeah. Now, one more question regarding politics, and then we'll get to some of our callers. Zika, obviously a huge issue of concern in South Florida.
Yeah.
And you are none too gentle, Carl Hyson, in a recent column in the Miami Herald regarding the actions of Republican Governor Rick Scott.
Well, all he does is whine about how the federal government isn't giving him any money. He's a Republican governor, and he can't get a nickel of Zika funding out of a Republican Congress in Washington. Obama, back in February, asked for almost $2 billion for Zika funding. They wouldn't give it to him unless they included cutting off funds to Planned Parenthood, which has nothing to do with Zika. So they salted it with that poison pill, and then they refused to pass it. But, so our governor, Rick Scott, he's a classic. He gives me a lot of material down there. So he holds these round tables, goes around the state telling people where the mosquitoes aren't. And he has these maps of neighborhoods saying we've isolated this outbreak to this 6-block area, like mosquitoes can read street signs, and there's only a couple billion of them down there, and they go where they want to go. And it's a big, serious health issue, but he should be in Washington persuading some of his Republican colleagues that we have a major health crisis instead of doing his little PR tour of Florida, trying to calm people down and convince tourists that it's okay to come down there. I mean, the nightmare scenario, of course, was when it was in this neighborhood called Wynwood and isolated there. And then when it popped up on South Beach, it's like a code red alert. Not South Beach, anywhere but South Beach.
Yeah.
Don't come over here.
On a serious note, I mean, personally, what's it like living in a place where Zika is a real threat?
We got so many threats down there. And let me just suggest to you that it's a terrible disease, but there's a lot of diseases you could catch on South Beach if you're not careful.
Okay.
Of course. We live in the tropics. There's going to be mosquitoes. We got alligators. We got crocodile. I mean, this is something we have to – but you can't carpet bomb the entire state of Florida with pesticide. Because that's not good either. When I lived in the Keys and they sprayed for mosquitoes down there, they would go over your house 10 times consecutively in an aircraft. You walked outside and you couldn't breathe. You were choking. You were gagging. It's a real concern. So you have to weigh the risks of the treatment versus the risks of, not very many people have symptoms when they get bit by a Zika mosquito. Most people show no symptoms whatsoever and they don't get sick. So you're talking about the only cases you know about are where someone got sick enough to report it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get back to the book. We've got a number of callers who are waiting to talk to you. And Alan in Westchester, you are live on Radio Times. Hello, Alan.
Good morning. I was working and my wife called and said, "You're on the radio. I just finished the book and enjoyed it tremendously." So naturally, I put everything aside and wanted to thank you for such a great book. I was lucky enough to get a signed copy as well, first edition. So that added to enjoying
the book. I'm glad you liked it, Alan. I'm really glad. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks
for saying
the call
that.
To Radio Times. We appreciate it. Nomar and Lansdowne, you're up next. How are you, Nomar?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, I'd like to ask about the effect of online publishing, how it affects your content, and it kind of ties into your job, how that affects the content and like
of the novels, no more of the newspapers.
Yeah, the novel, how they both kind of coincide with online publishing.
Okay.
Well, I mean, in my case, I just write the old-fashioned way, and I submit a manuscript, and it comes out, you know, in hardback as well as later paperback. And then the e-version, which I think is what you're referring to, the e-books, which it's interesting. With each new generation, I think, of novels or each new succession, you get more and more of the percentage of the readers when they track these things are reading on e-readers. So you also get readers who do both, who get a book, copy of the book, and then they'll get the e-reader thing. So it's been a mixed – I mean, they're still trying to figure out how it's working out. It certainly changed the business model for publishing because, obviously the cost of an electronic book is much less to the consumer than it is to the publishing house. At the same time, it's a lot lower overhead. So, whether it all balances or out or not, I don't know. But it hasn't affected the way I write or what I think about doing. I mean, I still do my thing, and I'm still lucky enough that people, after all these years, want to read it.
We appreciate the call, Nomar. Well, what do you prefer, Carl, when it comes to reading? Do you like an old-fashioned book where you can just, carry it around and feel the heft?
Yeah, I do. I like having the books, and I like carrying the books and just – and I also like being – I think it's – maybe I'm a little technologically challenged, but I like being able to go back and forth in a novel if I need to and look and thumb to the front of the book and look at a chapter just to pick up something I might have missed. And you can do that, I know, on ebooks, but it's a little more cumbersome. And I mean, I can barely operate my cell phone. I'm pitiful. So the idea of me trying to, get through Tolstoy on an e-reader would be a joke.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, let's continue with our calls to Ian in Philadelphia now. Ian, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
All right. What's your call or question, I should say, or do you have a comment for Carl Hyacin?
Well, my first comment is thank you very much for being active in political commentary. It's certainly needed these days, especially for both candidates, considering their malfeasance. And also a comment I'd like to get from you. I read a lot of Dave Barry books, such as Insane City and Big Trouble, as well as his column work. And I noticed you mentioned that you worked at the Miami Herald as well for quite some time. Is there a lot of crossover or commonality in your work?
Yeah, well, interesting question. Thanks, Ian.
Well, Dave and I have known each other for years and years, and we're still good friends. In fact, we've got an event together at the end of the month down in Miami. But we're all poaching from the same headline. So, that's why there's a resonance there. And Dave's obviously a hilarious columnist, and his novels were funny. And he's got a new book out now called Best State Ever, which is sort of a nonfiction, summary of all the craziness that Florida is and probably will continue to be. So, I mean, we're just as friends, and you work the same territory. Obviously, this is our reality. Living down there, the weirdness of Florida becomes our day-to-day reality. So that's and we joke about it. We laugh about it all the time because one thing happens, one thing happens crazier than the next almost every day. And it keeps you sane to be able to write about it and also to be as funny as he is about it. I mean, I think it keeps everybody a little saner if you happen to live down there. You know what I mean? I mean, it's almost like, hey, we're all in this together. You got to laugh about it.
Carl Hyacin, you also write children's books. And in doing some research for this show, I read in the publication Ocean Drive that your young readers are a chief inspiration for your work. Could you get into that for us? How do you mean?
Well, I think when you get, you know, if you've been doing this a long time, newspaper works or novels, you tend to get a little jaded about things. And when a few years ago, when they asked me to start, would you want to try to write a kid's novel? I thought they were out of their minds. I mean, I wouldn't have let my kids read my novels for sure. But they said, come on, they're into the environmentalism the way you are. They love sort of rebellious characters. They love the smart-ass humor particularly. And so I wrote Hoot, and I had no idea it was going to take off the way it did. And then I started getting letters. I was only going to do the one book, and I had an escape hatch in my contract and everything. And then I started getting these wonderful letters, these incredible letters from kids who were – and it's not just the idealism, the amount of energy they had, the amount of how aware they were of sort of not just the how important the planet was, but the whole, you know, the political turmoil about climate change and about just doing the right thing. They had such a clear view of what's right and wrong, and their view is usually right on accurate. And I just started getting, and I still to this day, I get just tons of mail from kids who read these novels. And it really is, it's inspirational in the sense that just when you think the world is hopeless and just when you think the politics of the United States, I mean, it couldn't get any lower. You hear from these kids who are so bright and smart and aware, and it gives you a little bit of hope because they're going to be running this place. They're going to be in charge in a few years. And I have to believe that they won't do as bad a job as my generation has.
Well, when Hoot was being made into a major motion picture, was it shot in Florida?
Yeah, it was all shot in Florida.
Did you influence that decision?
Well, I was. They were lucky enough to sort of include me, and I got to look at the scripts, and I was on the set a little bit because they shot some of it in Fort Lauderdale, some of it in Boca Grande, and some of it in the Keys, and so that part of it. Yeah, I mean, they were great. Will Schreiner directed it and wrote it. He's terrific, and he was very nice. And Jimmy Buffett was one of the producers, and he's an old friend of mine, and they were nice enough to include me in the process, which a lot of times doesn't happen in Hollywood and probably is a merciful thing when it doesn't happen. But they were nice. And the main thing we were trying to do is sort of capture the spirit of that novel, that little novel about these burrowing owls that were going to get killed because of some developers were going to come in. And that really happened when I was a kid. I mean, except in real life, the owls got wiped out. Mm-hmm. And I was determined when I wrote that book that I was going to put my own much happier ending on it. And they were true to that part of it. And, you know, making movies is a whole different deal than writing books. And I just have a lot of sympathy for not just the screenwriters, but producers, directors. You're trying to take sometimes a complicated story, and it's got to be a 100-page script, three acts. And my novels don't lend themselves to that. So I was just happy that Florida came across the way it did, and that the story was true to the book in that sense, the line of the novel.
So no desire to pack up and move to Hollywood.
Oh, hell no. Jeez, I'd have to be out of my mind. You know, I'm out there a fair amount, and I've got different, you know, people are always optioning the books and for projects, and I'm always trying to be as supportive as I can. But most of the screenwriters I end up talking to secretly want to be novelists because they're working for committees.
Yeah.
I mean, they get paid pretty well, but they're writing for committees, and I'm not. I've got my editor. And really, and my name is on the book. If it does well, that's great. If it tanks, it's my fault. But I mean, the idea of having something that's your own. I mean, if you're a writer, the idea is to write something that belongs to you, and that doesn't exist really. And I mean, it does. You know, you see some movies that are written and directed by one person, and they're usually pretty good. But the more people you get involved, the messier it gets and the process gets ugly.
Well, Carl, we have about 30 seconds left. At the end of the day to relax, I've read you like to head out to Florida Bay. Tell us just a bit about that.
No, I love to. I mean, I grew up down there fly fishing down there for tarpon and bone fishing. And you get out in the water. There are places you can go in the Everglades that haven't changed in thousands of years. And if you can find those places, it washes away all the rest of the craziness and anxiety. And that's what I try to do.
Nice to know they still exist. Carl Hyacin, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. Thanks, Mary.
Carl's newest novel is called Razor Girl. And as always, we invite you to like us on Facebook. Check out our Facebook page for some behind-the-scenes goings-on at Radio Times. Head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nouri. And as always, great to have you aboard. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.